The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead. The Big Lead. Top story.
Fine. Stepping all over the top story, Aaron Granillo is going to be coming into the studio because we're going to be talking about that toddler and three others who were injured in a Central District shooting, as well as John Curley will be joining us to balance out the kind of right v. right rhetoric that you will be hearing over the next 18 minutes. But Aaron Granillo, give us the details on this tragedy that happened with this toddler over the weekend.
Yeah, Jack, this happened yesterday, shortly after 3 o'clock. This happened at an AutoZone on 23rd and Jackson. So this is in the Central District in Seattle. At least one suspect, police say, was walking down 23rd when they started shooting. Seattle Police Detective Valerie Carson.
Reportedly, the suspect was traveling southbound on 23rd, came around the corner of this business, and shot east into the parking lot.
Now, what we don't know yet is if the shooter ran away on foot, if they had a getaway car. Police believe there is more than one suspect. They are actively looking for them right now. And still don't know if the shooter and victims knew each other. And again, just to recap the victims, sadly, one of them is a 2-year-old girl in critical condition at Harborview. The three others are their adult men. Two are in satisfactory condition. Don't know about the fourth quite yet. Here's what else we do know.
Before any emergency personnel could arrive, the victims all either transported themselves or were transported in personal vehicles to the hospital.
Cairo 7 TV caught up with one of the witnesses who was there. He tells them that he was in his car nearby when the bullets started flying, and he says he saw several shooters.
Before any emergency personnel could arrive, the victims all either transported themselves or were transported in personal vehicles to the hospital.
Now, of course, where the shooting happened in the Central District has been hit hard by gun violence for many years, and not a lot has changed despite the promises from various elected officials in the city and in that area specifically. And as for this investigation, homicide and forensic teams went through the scene in search of evidence. No word yet on if there were any cameras in the area, but Carson says they will be checking those if they are.
Cameras on businesses, dash cams, etc., anything that can provide us with some good evidence.
And of course, because this happened in broad daylight on an otherwise beautiful afternoon in Seattle, this is, you know, about 3:20 in the afternoon, blue skies, sun's out. She says if any witnesses are there, they want them to come forward. And Carson says, especially for the officers involved in this investigation and the community, because that little girl was shot, this is an especially difficult case for them.
Obviously, for a serious incident, when a 2-year-old is the victim of a shooting, it's a really tough thing, even for officers even to respond to.
And Jack, I did just check in with Harborview about an hour ago. Latest update there shows the girl still being treated. Latest update shows she's fighting to stay alive in critical condition right now.
Tough. Thank you very much, Aaron. I appreciate you taking a couple minutes out of your day to update us on that. Feel free to chime back in, by the way, if Jay Inslee decides to roll everybody back.
We are awaiting that announcement imminent, perhaps. Whenever it comes down, I'll be sure to let you know.
Thank you very much, sir. So John Curley is on the line, and John, I brought you on. I wanted to have you on, sir, because I'm going to blow a gasket, and I figured that I would have you on to try to, you know, keep it all moving, keep the show moving, because I am literally going to lose my mind.
Yeah. Well, I can make a gasket for you out of cork. I've learned how to do that. So if you do blow a gasket, an AccuKnife and a piece of cork, I could fix the gasket for you. Why are you upset, Jack? And first of all, thanks for filling in for Dory, but why gasket gasket impairment coming? Why is this?
Okay. So, John, you know that I have a bit of a checkered past. You know that I used to maybe roll with some of the darker elements of society, wrong side of the tracks. You know, when you're a jet for the rest of your life, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I noticed about this story, when I first read about it, is instantly in my brain, I go, oh, they didn't wait for the ambulance? That's gang activity. If you don't wait, and this is just from what I know on the streets, selling drugs, buying drugs, when you don't wait for the police, almost always it's due to gang activity because you don't want to be there. You want it to be kind of confusing. Now, the little girl, the 2-year-old girl, I can say that makes sense. But the rest of them, just to take off and go to the hospital, that's a huge red flag for gang activity. But, John, this was my other thought. When is Joe Biden going to come out and make a statement about this? Because this is clearly a tragedy beyond measure. This is clearly, you know, it's a mass shooting in the city. He's done it out of the last three that we've had over the last 4 weeks. He's done it three times. When is he going to come and say, we really have to do this for the state of Washington and the people of Seattle? When are we going to get that speech, John Curley?
Well, the problem is, you know, the expression blue blood, right? So certain people's blood means more than other. So if you have a blood that is spilled and that blood has the higher value, which is blood from a white police officer, a black man is bleeding because of a white police officer, there's a higher value to that particular blood than bullets fired indiscriminately into crowds in cities across America. I always point this out all the time on the show that it doesn't make any sense that you can have 16 people shot in a single weekend. You can have four die in Chicago. And no one talks about that. And the 8,600 and some that die every single year on the streets of big cities, 2% of the of all homicides are in 54% of all homicides occur only in 2% of the United States. And everybody knows where the counties are and they know where the areas are and they know where the problems are. But again, though, that blood has little value compared to other blood. And that's just the sad state of affairs that that we won't have the president or somebody else talk about it. Because the problem with that, Jack Stein, is once you get into starting to say, well, let's talk about why somebody feels it's okay or why somebody takes the chance of shooting somebody at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, that now you get into a whole complicated now. Is it cultural? Is it systemic racism? Is it a lack of jobs? Is it a lack of education? And that's far more complicated than simply just being able to say, well, it's white supremacist or it's brutal cops. That's easy to run politics off of. So the sadder thing is the kid and everybody else.
Right.
And if you just really want to have like a huge view of it, I used to do work with a group of guys that were all in gangs, got out of gangs, found God, and then started making furniture out of reclaimed wood. And I remember talking to them about why they shoot people or have they all been shot. They all lift up their shirts. They showed me where they were shot. And when you just get generally, you get this idea that if I pull out a gun and if you pulled out a gun, Jack, and you shot at somebody, and let's say you hit them, you lose so much. Your life now is in the toilet and will be in the toilet for a long time. The risk of somebody who's 18 years old, who has really nothing, to pull out a gun and shoot somebody, what are they risking and losing? Little compared to most people. So for them, they shoot because the upside is high. The downside isn't that great from where they consider themselves to be right now. And that's the sad reality of talking to those guys.
Right. John, could you imagine, though, let's just say hypothetically, that Joe Biden or whoever writes Joe Biden's speeches, if they wrote a great speech, it doesn't have to be long, make it 7.5, 8 minutes long, talking about the merits of community, talking about the merits of being involved with a church organization, talking about the merits of parents who stick together and raise their kids, even though they might want to get a divorce, they make the decision to stick around and raise their kids. Could you imagine talking just an 8 or a 9 minute speech about that, talking about what it means to get a high school education or community college education? That would have so much impact across partisan boundaries. As opposed to him going out and saying, well, we have this systemic racial problem with the police. I just think to myself, all of that is useless if you're not going to talk about what it means to have a good family unit. Every single aspect of it is useless. And that is why you get people shooting kids in the street, because they have bad mom, bad dad. Likely they dropped out of high school. They have no aspirations in life other than to sell drugs in an open air market. And people put up with it as if it is normal. And this is the thing that makes me completely just blow a gasket, John Curley. None of this is normal. People don't get shot in the street at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday. It does not happen. But we're supposed to walk around as if, oh, yep, yeah, we just live in a city where there's that level of crime. So when you said the other day, John Curley, on your show that you would, if you never came back to Seattle, it wouldn't make any difference to you. It resonated with me on a very deep level.
Why?
Because it is, at a certain point in time, people just get so fed up with something. And they say, if I can't do anything about it, if my elected officials aren't going to do anything about it, if they're not going to clear homeless people out of parks that are right next to schools, if we're going to allow open-air drug markets, if we're just going to let people rot in the street, what left do people have for their city, the city that they love, the city that they appreciate? Mm-hmm. Where do they go? If you're John Curley, you buy 10 acres and you live in a cabin where you can hide all your bodies. if you're Tom Tagney, Jack, you know, live what? In a hole in the ground.
Right. I love reading all sorts of history of, and I've been doing research on why cities die. Often they go to Detroit and they look at Detroit, but that's unusual because that city was built because of auto manufacturing and what happened with Japan and tariffs and everything else. But in general, here's the theory. You have a city, and when high income, it's a per capita income, begins to drop, as that begins to drop, and people sell homes, so it goes per capita income, those people move out, housing prices drop. And then as soon as those two things are in play, it is a fairly quick ride downhill. Because then other properties can't sell. Those that can afford to take the loss on the house or to leave. Then you have taxes begin to depreciate. They move. And then you begin to tax more and more of the people that are still there where they don't have enough money to begin with. So now there's more fees and fines. And then the police step in and they start, you know, more ticketing, more this, more that. And then also schools don't have any money because the real estate begins to leak out. So now you have even worse situations for schools. There's no growth when it comes to jobs. And there is the flight outside of that. And that is the beginning of how a city begins to die. So it would be interesting to see with Seattle, start looking at the per capita of income over the last, let's take from 2000, let's go 2018. That's a real high mark. And then you would just start to watch it. Now, does it begin to slide down? People say, well, the pandemic and everything else. But overall, the city council that we have in place and where we are with crime and how we treat our police officers with such little respect and little regard, that you'll see rich begin to move out. When they begin to go, housing prices go. And then where will Seattle be in 5 years? Eric Johnson did Seattle is Dying. And a lot of liberals make fun of it, saying, oh, yeah, right, Seattle is dying. But if you drive around the city and you look at the dirt and you look at the crime and you look at the graffiti and you start to say, this is not the city that I remember for so many years. Obviously, nobody cares about it. And or it seems like no one cares. And then you think, well, why should I bother being there? It's very sad. Hopefully, this is just a tiny, you know, little blip right now, and maybe you get some elected officials in there that are a little bit more realistic as to what the real problems are, and then perhaps the city does begin to turn around. But that little kid is so tragically stuck, and I don't need to take up all your time, but I remember when William F. Buckley was running for mayor in New York as a third-party candidate, and he did it primarily for publicity as a conservative, and he just wanted to show people different positions. They had a debate, and they asked about there are beliefs that there could be second-generation welfare recipients. This is, I think, 1968. The second generation was a concern. And somebody said, what would you do about it? And the three candidates were up on stage, and William F. Buckley said, I have the answer, and it's one word, and I'll spell it for you because you probably haven't seen it in a while unless you've read a Dickens novel, which, by the way, a lot of you will be talking about Charles Dickens after I say this word, and I will be excoriated in the press. And the word is orphanages. You need to remove the child from the environment that has created the first generation of welfare, or the child will learn the habits of that household. And, of course, the next day, William F. Buckley, you know, wants to tear children from the home and send them to orphanages But he is correct, and I'm not saying orphanages are the way, but what he's saying is you need to break somehow the habits that are creating the problems that are systemic to people that are living in an area where there is no hope. You can't get up. You can't get out. And they're stuck. So the next generation sees this. And for that little kid that's in the hospital, unfortunately, statistically speaking, that kid has been dealt a really, really bad hand, right? And
yeah,
another life not being able to live to its full capacity, I think is one of the greatest crimes against humanity.
Yeah, and I agree with you, particularly when it comes to children, and I think that's why this story stuck out to me so much, why it affected me so much, because now we're not talking about we're finding needles on the schoolyard. We're not talking about that anymore. Now we're talking about a two-year-old who was shot and is in critical condition, and I have yet to hear anybody say, okay, well, clearly there is something amiss if we're going to have open-air drug markets where people are holding guns. All I really want, John Curley, is for someone just to be on my level with it. Even if we disagree, you could be the most liberal socialist individual out there, but you could say, okay, well, open air drug markets where children can get shot. Clearly, we would all be on the same page with that, correct?
Yes, but you see, politics is not about solving those types of problems. Politics is good hat. A black hat, white hat, good guy, bad guy. You need to divide people into groups and then point fingers and then begin to disperse large sums of money to groups that are demanding the money. But the metrics are never going to measure how to really affect stuff. It all has to come from the community within the community. And it has to come. I mean, Dennis Prager put up a billboard to raise money for a billboard. Less guns or more fathers? What would save more lives? And unfortunately for the family, the father in the house and the mother in the house and the kids surrounded by, you know, loving, caring individuals that are able to, you know, raise that kid and have a kid go to a good school. And, you know, it's a struggle that unfortunately has been with us for as long as we've had, you know, the government involved in our urban areas, providing free this, free that, but little or no regard for the soul of the individual to be able to fully live. So can't solve the problem for you, Jack Stein, but listen, I got to say this. Yeah. Thanks for filling in for Dory. He has only missed 2 days of his entire career at Cairo.
Yes.
calling in sick. It was last week. And this week, and he is the Iron Man of radio. And I love your show at night. I listen all the time. And thanks for being part of Cairo.
Anytime, John Curley. Thank you so much for coming on and keeping this segment balanced, because I was about to lose my mind over this issue. We got to take a really quick break. When we get back, Hannah Scott's going to be coming in to talk about the new measures restricting use of force for the police. We'll be right back after this. On the line right now, Hannah Scott, National Treasure. Hannah Scott. It's been a while, Hannah Scott, since you and I spoke. And as per usual, we're coming in hot with some new talk about police use of force. Break it down for us.
Absolutely. So this is one of more than a dozen police accountability bills that are a package, really one of the main focuses of the entire legislature for this particular session. And this has to do specifically with the use of force. Now, I lose a year in the pandemic. So I think it was 2019 is when we had, my sense of time is all off. Voters had passed Initiative 940, which was took a couple of years at least to get through the legislature, and then it eventually had to go to voters to basically overhaul our state's police accountability system when it comes to deadly use of force. We had a really, really low bar or high bar to prosecute any officers. It required that you prove an officer acted with malice when they used deadly force in order to even try to get a prosecution. So there was never anything like that. And there was some questionable cases in the state. So the voters and the families of those killed by police, they got that to the ballot, passed it. And then the legislature knew that people wanted change. That all spiraled into what we see now, which is more bills on top of that, because some of the rules that were in that ballot measure have not really been coming to fruition. Some of it lays out the way force should be used. And it requires independent investigations for all deadly use of force cases, but that hadn't been happening. So now we've got all these new bills. And this specific one for deadly use of force or for use of force requires that an officer only use deadly force when there is a threat of imminent bodily harm, significant bodily harm or death to either that officer or another person. It hasn't been spelled out that way anywhere before. So Senator Jamie Peterson explained why this was so important.
The community of family members and survivors, people who have advocated for reform and for justice in this area have brought us this bill because they have observed that the reforms that the people requested in passing Initiative 940 have not been quite sufficient to the task, and that we continue to witness incidents of excessive force deployed by our officers.
And he said that this actually is meant to benefit the officers.
We want to empower officers to do the right thing. We want to give them guidance about the standards that we expect them to uphold. And this is a carefully nuanced bill that will provide that guidance to our law enforcement officers about our expectations for them as they do their best every day to try to do justice and uphold the laws that we pass in this body.
So on top of the laying out the specifics for when you can use deadly force, it lays out when you can use any physical force. It also requires that before you do any kind of force whatsoever, you've used whatever less lethal options there are. And that includes de-escalation tactics such as verbal, talking to the person, and also leaving. It requires that an officer, if there's no crime actually being committed, so this would come into play probably if you've got someone in a drug or mental health kind of crisis. If there's nothing that is a crime that is actually being done, de-escalate by leaving the officer, they added to the bill right before this last vote. Yeah, leave the scene. And it's come up before.
What?
Yeah.
What? No, this is the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. You leave when someone's having a mental emergency or they're having a full mental meltdown, you just get back in your squad car and you go, well, nothing more I can do about that, and then you just drive off.
I think the idea is that they would call for crisis responders or mental health providers or some kind of counselor. We have some of those crisis counselors, and there's other bills going through right now that would bring more of them. So that's the idea. But in some cases, yes. I mean, even with like protests and riots that we've seen here, the argument always is that because there's so many officers there, kind of in their riot gear waiting for something to happen, that escalates things. We had a shooting down at the waterfront, I think a month and a half, maybe 2 months ago, and it was a man in crisis who, I forget how they were called down there. He was just down by the waterfront alone. There was no one around him. He was not a threat to anyone because there was no one there. But the cops came in really hot, and they ended up, the guy had a knife, and he came at them screaming, kill me, please kill me. And that's what happened, because he came at them with a knife. So perhaps backing away from that a little bit. So remains to be seen. There would be some training involved in this and some full proposals written out through this program. I think the attorney general has to come up with model policies in like a year and a half that would be trained throughout the state. But Republicans either way say this is not the best idea. And Republican Doug Erickson warned this.
The people will be less safe because law enforcement officers will not be able to take the steps that many people who pick up the phone and dial 911 would like those law enforcement officers to take.
But Democratic Senator David Frock came back with this.
This bill does not prevent the use of force when it's necessary. It lays out some parameters, but it certainly is not intending to prevent police officers from protecting us, protecting anyone else. I think that we need to be specific in our language as we debate this bill and others that may come up.
And this is super divisive. You know, again, there's more than a dozen right. bills. You've got the cops feel like they're attacked a lot of the time. And this was very much split down the middle. In fact, some Democrats ended up voting against it. It still passed. But one of the really interesting things to come out of this floor debate happened when Republican Senator Mike Patton threw in a provision saying we want to make sure that a type of force that's still allowed to be used is tear gas in the event of a riot. And that immediately got pushed back from Democrats who said, no, don't do that.
Tear gas is banned in wartime. It is not a tool that our police need to be able to use on peaceful protesters or, frankly, on any protesters, even if someone has decided that there's a riot situation.
There was a collective Republican cringe in the room when he said that, and it was virtual. Yeah. I could still feel it. But so here's the deal. So after he says that, again, that's Democratic Senator Jamie Peterson, Democratic Senator Steve Hobbs, who's a National Guard reserve. He's actually at National Guard duty. He comes in on the Zoom with this warning.
I have been there. I have been there facing a crowd of hundreds with just a few people. And not having that non-lethal capability, not having it is a recipe for disaster. When you have thousands of people in one area, there is going to be an element that wants to be violent when you have that many people around. As it gets worse and worse and worse, and you have no means to control the violence, if it gets out of the hand, then you need to have non-lethal capability. Having the use of tear gas puts another level before the use of lethal force.
And that was his point. You often hear that from the Republican side, but you hadn't heard that from the Democrats. And he went on for a very long time and really made a very impassioned speech, having been in Bosnia, having been deployed in places where there were these incredible riots with thousands of people around with just a few of them. And nobody wants to kill anybody was his point. They don't want that and his son is National Guard now. And he said, you know, he didn't want his son to have to go through that, but we've got to have these less lethal options. So that amendment actually got added to the bill, much to the chagrin of some of the other Democrats.
This is not good, Hannah Scott, but I'll tell you this. There is kind of a little ray of sunshine. If, unfortunately, there are riots over the summer or the George Floyd case, the Derek Chauvin case does not go the way that people want it to go, which is my prediction.
I'm so worried.
You will see, I am as well, you will see riots in the streets, and then all of a sudden everybody will be coming back to the Senate, and they're going to be coming back, and everyone's going to say, whoops, super sorry about that. We made a huge mistake. So it all sounds really fun and nice on paper, but then when you get to the application of it, that is when these great ideas, all of a sudden you find out, oh, wait, we don't want to literally handicap the people whose job it is to protect our lives and our businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, I mean, look, there's this, again, there's all collectively, if you take the bills that are currently passing, there's this incredible training and conversation that they want to have about really making sure that your focus, that the any kind of force is your very, very last option, especially deadly use of force, and that you're changing the way you think as an officer, that you focus on that de-escalation and consider the mental disabilities of people and substance use disorder and things like that. Change the old school way of thinking and thinking in a different way, but they haven't got that up and going yet. So the good news is I don't think this takes effect until the beginning of next year, some of it. So we might be good if there are summer riots with just doing it the old way. However, I know that there's going to be independent investigations into any deadly use of forces incidents. And now they've got another bill that limited a bunch of other tactics. So you can't do chokeholds, you can't do neck restraints, you can't do no-knock warrants, and you're limited on a variety of other aspects of policing as well. So their hands are somewhat tied.
Hannah Scott, thank you so much for coming on the Dory Monson Show. We do appreciate it. We'll take a really quick break. We'll be right back after this. All right, welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. Dory Monson is ill today. He will be back tomorrow. He is the Iron Man of radio. He's only missed 2 days. One of them was last week, and the other one was today. And they said, Jack Stein, you're the only guy that can fill those big, big shoes. And I said, you got it. Happy to do it for Mr. Dory Monson any day of the week. So I'm looking at this article. It says, music can be as addictive as fast food, money, and alcohol. I find this exceedingly difficult to believe, but a study was done by McGill University saying that the findings reveal how music can be as addictive as these substances. Scientists explained that pleasant tunes trigger an area of the brain called the nucleus accumbens. It's the reward center. Using scans, scientists discovered firing up the neurons increased a listener's enjoyment. On the other hand, pleasure dropped when researchers dampened those nerve cells. I shudder to think of what they did to those poor people when they were doing this experiment. But I was trying to think about it as a former drug addict. I don't, Tarek, do I talk about this enough? Do I talk about my previous drug addiction enough on air?
Oh, I don't think, I think you need to talk about it more personally, in all honesty. I really do.
I just...
I do.
So as a former drug addict, I can tell you that I never jonesed for like a Stevie Nicks record. I never was, you know, trying to hit up my dealer for a really sweet Genesis B-side. It just never happened.
Jack, let's...
Yes, sir.
I hate to interrupt you, but that's some shade on Genesis. And I got to say, you know, the greatest band of all time needs some more respect. Phil Collins, one of the greatest bald men ever to live. So let's be fair here. Okay.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. But this is my whole point, is that they are trying to say that it's as addictive as these substances. But when I think about the intense withdrawal that my body went through coming off of, let's say, heroin or cocaine, when I finish listening to, Rubber Soul by the Beatles, I don't automatically break out into cold sweats and start wanting to go through my carpet as Hunter Biden did, looking for little bits of the record. It just doesn't happen. So maybe this isn't the best comparison. On the other side, though, the other side of this whole thing is that sometimes I get in this weird loop, and let me know if this happens to you as well, 98973, State Roofing Text Line, where you will listen to the same song over and over and over and over again. It happens to me on a semi-regular basis. And sometimes it can be something really nice, like a piece of classical music. The other day, however, I got stuck on that song, All About That Bass. I could not stop listening to that song. I must have listened to it 12 times in a row. I hate that song.
Ugh. But Jack, I respected you, man. I respected you.
I know.
You let me down.
But for some reason, I simply could not get it out of my brain. So there, you could say that there's almost a compulsion, or there's almost a desire to want to figure out the pieces of a song. I play piano, I play guitar, I play bass, I've written music previously. So there is this idea of needing to go over something again and again and again to try to figure out all of the pieces. But as far as it being as addictive as food, money, and alcohol, they go on to say that this is something deep within our brains. This is at a point in the brain which was formed early in our evolutionary tract. So the argument being is that we are kind of musical beings, and we've always kind of been that way, or at least we have been for at least the last couple of 100,000 years, which raises the question, how much further could we take it? How much further could that part of our brain open up, and how much more music could we really be making over the next couple thousand years?
Yeah, exactly. Whenever I hear Maneater by Hall & Oates, I'm telling you, I feel it. I feel it.
Is not funny.
Oh, it's a great song. Let's play next hour. Let's play next hour.
That is my least favorite song. We have to take a really quick break. When we get back, we're going to be doing the Fastest 15. I'm Jack Stein, filling in for Dory Monson. We'll be right back after this.